The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Well, welcome to the program. My guest is Scott Spaulding. He is the head of high net worth private markets at CBRE Global Investors. He's responsible for product development and client management within the United States private wealth market. He joined the firm back in 2018. He's got an 18-year career at PIMCO prior to that. PIMCO needs no introduction. And he also has a CFA he received his bachelor's degree from UCLA and an MBA from USC. The only reason I mention that, of course, because I never talk about people's degrees, is because, he's a Bruin and a Trojan, which means that he has quite a dilemma every time it's football or basketball season. Scott, who do you pull for? Are you a USC fan or a UCLA fan? Where's your allegiance lie after having attended both universities?
Well, it's a very simple answer, Mike. I am very much a UCLA Bruin because I played football at UCLA and I was the captain of the UCLA football team. So my allegiances are to the Bruins.
And was Dick Vermeil the coach at the time or did he predate you?
He predated me a little bit. Terry Donahue was the coach.
Okay. You know, I had no idea that you played football there, Scott, or I wouldn't have even had to ask you a question. What position did you play?
I was an offensive guard, and that, fortunately, was about 50 pounds ago.
Wow. Okay, 50 pounds of pure muscle, let's say. Okay. So nobody out negotiates Scott Spaulding. Let's stipulate that right now. We're not here to talk sports, though, although that was a nice little aside. We're here to talk about a report that Scott authored for CBRE, and it really took a look at core real estate investing by institutional investors vis-a-vis core real estate investing by individual investors. There's quite a discrepancy there, but the real point of the paper that Scott wrote, and I'm going to ask him some questions to really detail this, is that individual investors were already starting to see a trending towards more core real estate investing by the individual investor as real assets or hard assets and alternatives become a bigger proportion of individual portfolios, investment portfolios. And some of the barriers that traditionally have been standing in the way of the individual investor and maybe the family office investor, they're starting to come down. And these are some of the findings that Scott dug into and put into this report. So we'll get into the details. So Scott, listen, first of all, thank you for taking the time to be on the program and spend some time going through the details of this.
Thank you, Mike.
Let's begin with what is driving advisor interest in private real estate, because the advisors at the wealth advisory firms are showing a greater interest in it. What's fueling that?
Absolutely, Mike. You're right about that, and I'll highlight two reasons behind the increased interest in private real estate amongst advisors. One relates more to the demand side of the equation and the other to the supply side. So first, as it relates to demand, there's a strong need among advisors for stable income within client portfolios. And this is really a result of persistently low policy rates in the post GFC era. And those low policy rates have had the effect of driving up prices and driving yields down across most income producing asset classes. So dividend yielding stocks, high quality bonds, those have been hit especially hard, but so too have other categories such as high yield bonds. So in their search for yield, advisors have had to broaden their opportunity set, and private real estate has benefited from increased demand. So secondly, if we go over to the supply side, we've witnessed the entry of institutional quality real estate solutions into the private wealth marketplace. And that growth in supply is being driven in part by the simple realization amongst institutional money managers that the high net worth market is an area of growth. And then secondly, in part by an evolution in the investment vehicles and in and advancements in financial intermediation. And what I mean by that is we've seen an evolution from version 1.0 of the non-traded REIT to version 2.0. And with technology and platforms such as iCapital or CAIS that are really providing advisors with access to private funds that previously had only been available to institutional investors. So advisors today have a lot more by way of investment choices than they did just 2 or 3 years ago.
So let's talk about the past and the present. So how have advisors gained access to private real estate in the past? And then how are they gaining that exposure today? I think you've kind of alluded to how it's starting to happen now, but why don't you wrap that up for us? In the past, in fact, in the past, it seems like they didn't really include real estate a whole lot in portfolios. I mean, alternatives were not a big part of individual portfolios, but if there's one alternative or real asset that everybody seemed to warm to, and everybody seemed to understand, the average Joe understands real estate. So, and in a sense, real estate has that big advantage of, you know, a person lives in a house or even if they rent a place, they understand real estate. They tend to trust real estate. It's solid. It's tangible and so on. But how do they access it in the past to a lesser degree, I guess, than they are today? And what, how are they doing it now?
Yes. You know, it's an interesting observation because we all feel a familiarity with real estate. And in fact, the most traditional way for high net worth clients to gain exposure to private real estate is simply through their personal property holdings. And in fact, you know, one of the major concerns that advisors voice to us is a worry about providing their clients with too much exposure to real estate, meaning this, that a high net worth client may have a second home, they may have rental properties, they may have a commercial property that their business is housed on. And generally, if we went back in time, the thought was that high net worth clients were generally fully exposed to private real estate. You know, however, given the need for additional yield in portfolios, we talked about advisors broadening the opportunity set and really taking a second look at real estate, because core real estate and other types of income producing real estate properties can offer a significant advantage from an income perspective vis-a-vis dividend-paying stocks, high-yield bonds, and the like. So essentially, private real estate has gotten a second look, if you will. So today, let's go from that traditional thinking of, hey, I've got personal real estate holdings, I'm good, to today and how advisors are gaining access to the private real estate strategies. And they're doing so through, in certain cases, newer instruments such as interval funds, which really have been around for quite a while but have only recently gained momentum. And then this version 2.0 of the non-traded REITs. And then lastly, these institutional private funds. And each of these structures, Mike, has a common thread. They provide investors with systematic and diversified exposure to commercial real estate that, in our view, the vast majority of individual investors cannot gain through personal real estate holdings. So these are institutional quality private real estate funds that allow investors to broaden their exposure to the asset class in a way that is distinct, in fact, from their individual property holdings. You know, core real estate are high quality properties located in prime markets that are well occupied by creditworthy tenants with long-term leases. And importantly here, very important point, you know, core real estate invests in a stratum of the market that is beyond the reach of most of us as individual investors. And I'll provide you with an example. You know, the average property value in a commonly used core real estate index is somewhere between 85 and 110 million. So we truly are talking, you know, a different segment of the commercial real estate market than individual investors are used to being invested in.
So you've named a few different vehicles there. So what are the relative advantages of each of the different investment vehicles? Because you mentioned the non-traded REIT, which, as you say, has gotten a second life. Blackstone has brought its skills to bear there in a huge way. It's just been a magnet for money. And you mentioned interval funds, and then I believe just real estate funds. I'm not sure if you're talking about open end or some other version of that, Scott, but what are the relative advantages to each? Because I can imagine an advisor sitting out there thinking, it sounds good, but which one is really most advantageous to my client?
Sure. And that last part of the question is very relevant. You know, the advantages to interval funds and non-traded REITs, Mike, is that these vehicles are available to a broad number of investors. And if we compare that to private investment funds, when we talk about private, we're talking about a non-registered investment vehicle. And these private funds are available only to qualified purchasers. And the SEC defines a qualified purchaser as an individual investor with at least $5 million in investable wealth. And investable wealth is wealth beyond that wealth invested in your primary residence. So, advantage to interval funds, non-traded REITs is most, if not all, investors generally can invest in those products. The advantage to private funds is that they're a very sophisticated investment vehicle that are typically invested in by institutional investors. However, they're limited in terms of who can invest in these private funds. But indeed, the advantage of private funds, and I'm speaking about those managed by leading institutional investment managers who might have open-ended core real estate funds. You know, these vehicles tend to be the types of structures that the largest and most sophisticated investors in the world utilize to gain exposure to private real estate. And they also tend to be attractive from a fee perspective.
Let's talk about taxes, because I think about real estate as being tremendously tax efficient. The tax code has all kinds of goodies in there for real estate. When it comes to private real estate investments, I would make this other point as well, that oftentimes one of the criticisms of some advisors and some RIAs is that they don't spend enough time looking at tax efficiency and tax advantages for their clients. And over the long term, it can cost their clients a lot of money and unrealized gains. So what about tax policy and how has it affected private real estate investments maybe over the years and maybe today, because we did just recently have numerous revisions to the tax code.
Yes, we did, and very notably as recently as 2 years ago, in fact, in December of 2017, you know, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017 introduced several measures, in fact, that affect private real estate strategies. And notably for the types of vehicles that we're talking about here, you know, those vehicles, Mike, even certainly if it's a non-traded REIT, the real estate asset, the actual property, is held in the form of a REIT. And in fact, private real estate funds, even though they may be structured as a Delaware limited partnership, many of those funds hold real estate assets in a private REIT. And the new tax law offers one major potential benefit for investors in private real estate funds that hold properties within REITs. And the new tax law allows for a 20% reduction in federal income tax on ordinary dividends that are distributed from a REIT. So essentially, you get a 20% tax break on the income coming from the REIT. And the result is an effective federal income tax rate, applicable to REIT income of 29.6%, and compare that to 37%, which of course is the tax rate for an individual investor in the highest tax bracket. So we've got, as you said, some beginning benefits, and then with, you know, the tax cuts in 2017, some additional benefits that allow investors to reduce that ordinary income tax on REIT dividends from 37% down to 29.6%, which is actually a really big deal.
So let's get back to Access here for a minute, because it used to be very expensive to play in this league. Now, today, the typical minimum investment and hold time, that's one of the things that individual investors and advisors have been very sensitive to. That situation has gotten a lot better, is my understanding. So what about that, the typical minimum investment and hold time for, say, a private real estate fund?
Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about private, institutional private real estate funds, the ones that pension funds and endowments and foundation that they invest in, these are typically products, and if we go back, you know, say 5 years, that were investments that had $5 million minimums, perhaps $10 million minimums, and that really, you know, isolated the types of clients that could invest in these structures to institutions. And we talked a little bit earlier in our conversation about some of the advancements really in financial intermediation, in technology, that allows an institutional money manager to provide access to a broader number of investors, including individual investors, at lower investment minimums. So really what we're talking about from an investment minimums perspective is somewhere around $250,000 and can be as low as $100,000 to invest in a product that, say, 5 years ago, Mike, would have a $5 million investment minimum. And then, importantly, some of the administrative work is also being lessened, or the burden is being lessened by, you know, the automation and streamlining of some of the processes associated with subscribing to a private fund and then redeeming out of a private fund. Now, in terms of sort of the hold time, if you will, related to private real estate funds, and this likely applies to any of the strategies that we're talking about, interval funds or non-traded REITs and private investment funds. Now, these are typically considered strategic allocations within investor portfolios, and generally strategic allocations are considered within a secular time frame, which is to say a minimum of a 3 to 5 year holding.
Interesting. Now, we have talked in the past, during our past conversations, Scott, you really put an emphasis on core real estate. How should advisors differentiate core real estate from other types of income generating real estate strategies, such as value add or opportunistic?
Yes, it's a great question, Mike. So let's start with some of the basics, which are sort of what are the different factors at play. Within private real estate strategies, generally they're differentiated by a number of characteristics. One is the physical condition of the properties. Are we talking Class A, Class B, Class B, C type properties? Building locations. Are we in a central business district? Are we outside the central business district? Occupancy levels. Typically properties that are 90% or more occupied are considered core real estate. The creditworthiness of tenants and critically the amount of debt used in the capital structure. So one of the main differences between the various income producing real estate strategies, and if we're talking about the three vehicles that we've discussed, non-traded REITs and core real estate funds, for example, the big difference is in the amount of leverage within these structures. Certain vehicles, and here I'm referring specifically to non-traded REITs, can run moderate to high levels of leverage. Say in the range, the high end of perhaps 60%, what we call loan-to-value leverage. So think of a $100 million property with a $60 million mortgage. That would be 60% loan-to-value leverage. Now, a core real estate strategy, on the other hand, employs a modest amount of leverage, typically in the 20 to 25% range. So think of that same $100 million building, but now with just 20 or 25 million in a mortgage. So a more conservative investment strategy. A second difference that I'll highlight, is the type of commercial real estate properties in which these funds invest. So what you'll find with certain strategies is a strong tilt towards a particular property type, and it might be multifamily, for example, or material allocations to what we call specialty property types. This might be hotels. So let's use that as a comparison to core real estate funds. Core real estate funds focus on the major categories within commercial real estate, what we call the four main food groups. And these four property types are office, apartments that are known as multifamily, industrial, and retail. And moreover, core real estate funds typically are diversified across those property types. So when we're talking about core real estate, we're really talking about a well-defined asset class. from a leverage perspective, from the perspective of what property types a core fund invests in and what it might doesn't invest in. So it's limited to a very small percentage of the portfolio that potentially could be invested in value add or any sort of development. So core real estate strategies are generally considered more foundational assets or within an asset allocation, kind of long-term holds, which are very income-driven and conservative investment strategies.
So you've obviously put a lot of this information out on the table already, Scott, but let's talk about the rationale for including core real estate in an investor portfolio, because there's a lot of advisors who have never really dealt with private real estate or core real estate this directly. What is the rationale? Where does it fit in that portfolio? What kind of work does it do for a portfolio?
You bet. It's a great question, Mike. And that was, an impetus behind, writing the paper was to discuss this asset class and this well-defined asset class. We talked about the criteria for core real estate and the fact, and I'm introducing this fact at this point, I guess, that you can model core real estate because there's a well-defined market proxy or a benchmark. And what investors will find is that core real estate offers four potential benefits within a portfolio context. And the first we've discussed, and it in fact is the attraction currently within the marketplace, which is strong and stable income, which is to say that these are properties with long-term leases by credit-worthy tenants, and that provides predictable income. And over the past 20 years, core real estate has produced an annualized income return of 6%. So income is number one. Second is just attractive risk-adjusted returns. Your core real estate has produced high risk-adjusted returns, meaning strong returns with relatively low volatility. So think of volatility between core fixed income and high-yield bonds. Somewhere, if you measure volatility by standard deviation, somewhere in that component of the risk-reward spectrum. And that has the effect of improving the efficiency in your portfolio, meaning what is my unit of risk or return, I should say, versus my unit of risk. So return divided by risk. And core real estate is very attractive when measured by something like a Sharpe ratio. Third is the inflation hedging attribute. So land values and rents typically rise with inflation, and because of that, real estate can provide, at least a partial long-term hedge against inflation. And the fourth, of course, is good old-fashioned diversification. Core real estate has low correlation with equities and, in fact, a slightly negative correlation with fixed income over the past 25 years.
That all sounds good, but what about the advisor who pushes back and says, I've got my clients and models that are well populated by REITs, by publicly traded REITs, and all four food groups, all four property types that you just named are represented in there. So why do I need to venture into private real estate, some kind of private real estate strategy when I've got my clients so well invested in publicly traded REITs? What's the differentiation there?
Yeah, the differentiation, between listed REITs and private real estate is that listed REITs are companies that they're operating companies that offer shares in businesses that either own, operate, or finance income producing real estate. Private real estate funds, in comparison, provide direct equity ownership in properties. So private real estate funds provide exposure without the complicating factors associated with listed REIT securities. And those could be the company's capital structure, its business enterprise value, and then just the broader equity market beta or the market volatility associated with stocks. And to be sure, listed REITs exhibit long-term correlation with, you know, core real estate assets, but they have a distinct risk reward profile, and they're often used, Mike, to play a different role in portfolio construction. Now, to be clear, in our view, this is not an either or type question. Should I invest in listed REITs or should I invest in private real estate? It's more of a view that advisors should have an allocation to both listed REITs as well as private real estate.
Now, I've heard, and I don't know if you concur with this, Scott, but one of the arguments against publicly traded REITs, solely publicly traded REITs, is that they tend to act more as an equity than the fundamentals of the real estate they hold, that they rise and fall with the market, just like any other equity, without really taking into account that there's real estate fundamentals within the REIT that is much more solid than the market is giving it credit for, that it doesn't really act as real estate, but more as a general equity.
And there certainly are elements to that statement that are correct. These are operating companies, right? These are businesses, and you're buying equity in the operating company. So there are equity elements involved in listed REITs, and that's less the case when you invest directly in private real estate.
So let's say an advisor came to you and said, I want to integrate private real estate into my clients' portfolios. How do I do that successfully? What kind of concentration do I have to actually move the needle?
Yes. So, you know, it's a great question, and there's some good academic research out there, and real estate, and this is sort of intuitive, you know, real estate very much, you know, depends upon time horizon. And certainly it does when we're buying individual real estate assets ourselves, but it also is relevant when an advisor is considering a private real estate fund for their clients. So the academic research suggests that real estate is an attractive asset class within a portfolio context. It also shows that the amount of real estate exposure depends on an investor's time horizon, which is to say the longer the time horizon, the larger the weighting to real estate should be within a portfolio. Now, in terms of core real estate, for time horizons of, say, 5 years or longer, you know, I was reading a study just recently that suggests that an advisor or an investor might consider an allocation of around 10% to core real estate funds within their portfolio. And at the beginning of our conversation, you had referenced institutional investors. And interestingly enough, institutional investors, you know, tend to have somewhere between 10 and 12% on average in private real estate, and somewhere around 80% or so is in core real estate. So we're sort of tracking, Mike, if you will, toward that same, you know, kind of 8, 9, 10% type number.
Now, final question, Scott. how important to this whole discussion is how core real estate is expected to perform going forward. And I ask that question because, as you well know, core real estate's gotten expensive, especially in first-tier markets. You go to places like New York, Miami, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles. It's very expensive. And I know this from even institutional investors have gotten to the point where they're saying, you know, we just can't make this pencil in certain markets. But again, I emphasize certain markets. There are other markets often referred to as secondary markets or you know, one level down, not even necessarily secondary markets, but one level down from the tier one markets to try to find something that pencils out a little bit better. What about the expensive core real estate and its ability to perform going forward? Because we're starting off at a high level, and everybody knows real estate goes up, it goes down, but it always goes up again, and it always seems to go higher. But that being the case, or nonetheless, what about its performance going forward? If somebody was looking to get involved and is looking at a 5-year or 10-year period of lockup.
It's a great question, the right question, in fact, Mike. So let's take a little bit of a step back here, right? We spoke about the long-term attributes of core real estate, and the first one we talked about was strong and stable income, and we referenced a 6% number. And is that 6% number relevant on a go-forward basis? And the answer is, and as suggested by you, that prices have increased. And when prices increase, yields go down. And yields converted in real estate speak are cap rates. And cap rates have compressed as more capital has flowed into income-producing real estate assets. So that's definitely the case. And over the long run, core real estate has been dominated, the return stream has been dominated by income. There also, however, has been a capital appreciation component to the return. So think in very general terms that perhaps 75% of the return stream has been income, with another 25% being capital appreciation. So we need to think in those two terms when we talk about the forward-looking return expectations for core real estate. And indeed, you know, our expectation is that returns for, you know, core real estate will likely be primarily income driven with little contribution from changes in asset prices. So again, the reason that investors are focused on core real estate, which is income, is likely to be, you know, or constitute the majority of their, quote, total return over, say, the next 3 to 5 years. Now, importantly, the economic backdrop, which is characterized by a strong labor market, low interest rates, modest but steady economic growth, that continues to support real estate fundamentals. And very importantly, because we discussed leverage, and if it's core real estate using modest 20 to 25% leverage or higher leverage type strategies, interest rates are really important, right? And the Fed's pivot from tightening to accommodative monetary policy, which really, you know, has transpired over the last 12 months, has calmed investors' fears about rising interest rates, and it's calmed investors' fears about expanding cap rates in core real estate assets. So that has two effects, right? So expanding cap rates would mean lower prices. And then The other effect relates to the cost of borrowing on your leverage, right? So if we, as core real estate managers, can borrow at attractive rates, then debt remains accretive to investment returns, and that's important. So let me try to sum it up very quickly. We expect that, you know, solid economic fundamentals support modest rent growth and high overall occupancy levels in core real estate, which support what we call net operating income growth. So the actual income coming off of properties. Now, rising cap rates and decelerating rent growth will likely mitigate capital returns, but, you know, taken together, we expect the result is continued positive returns for core real estate assets, with the majority of that return stream being income.
If an advisor wants to get a copy of your report, Scott, and dig into all these details and have it right there in front of them, is there an easy way to get their hands on it?
On our website, which is cbreglobalinvestors.com.
Okay, terrific. So another question for you, actually. I do have one more. Anybody who's a football fan knows that the offensive linemen are the biggest, meanest, and strongest guys on the field. So how much were you putting up on bench at your peak?
Well, I had about a 385-pound bench press, which was respectable, but not great. I was a little bit better at the squat. So squat's important, good leg strength, and in that exercise, the one-time max is a little bit dangerous, if you will, because the weight can get pretty high. But I did 475 pounds for a set of five in the squat, and that means wow. The top of the legs parallel with the ground. So that that's where I was. That was my relative strength there, Mike.
Yeah, there you have it. Offensive lineman, it's from the waist down. That's it, right? The driving power. So, Scott, hey, I appreciate you taking the time, and we learned a lot. Scott, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mike.